Okay, hi everyone, I'm Doozy. And as promised today, I bring you a talk that includes sex, drugs, and computers. Called Preventing Viruses from STDs to EXEs. A little bit about me, a recovering library sciences major in college. Before I graduated though, I did a couple of other things and worked a lot with literature review studies. Does everyone know what a literature review is? When a organization wants to do a controlled trial, they first do a study of prior art to make sure that there are no other studies that repeated that process. And if there are, then the study changes to a verification process instead of original testing. So it was a lot of time in the library. And sometime during college, I got tricked into making the full-time switch to being a security pro instead of doing it just socially. I got convinced somehow that I could make hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, doing security. I think it was the number one rated job for graduates in 2000. So I'll let you know how that turns out. So far, so good. And my specialty in the security field is project management process and security in the software development lifecycle. But so you've all heard of people, process, and technology. In security, the idea is that all problems can be solved with a combination of these three things. And if you're a diehard security professional and you're honest with yourself, you'll probably agree that everyone has one of these three things that they think is a lot more important than the other two. You know, if you're a technology person, then you secretly kind of think that if we could just get a firewall that was smart enough, we'd be able to stop all of the security vulnerabilities from affecting the system. If you're a process person, you think that testing is the way to, you know, solve security problems, and if we could just find out what was going on early enough, then we could solve security problems. And I think, personally, that people are the solution, and if we can just get people to adopt a certain kind of behavior, then we can solve security problems. So before I get into my theory, I would like to take you back to the 80s. The 80s were a magical time. We were sending people into space on manned space flights. Reagan was single-handedly solving the Cold War, and there was a virus that swept across the United States, killing hundreds of thousands of people, originally called things like gay cancer. We eventually came to the conclusion that it should be called HIV. And before they were able to come up with an antiretroviral treatment in 1996, it killed hundreds of thousands of people. Now, in the 21st century, there's a different kind of virus that is sweeping the country and that we need to be concerned about. And instead of people in nightclubs and drug users catching the virus, it's people at home, people in America, and they're catching the virus in their computers. And it's coming from, you know, the black hat hackers and the people on Facebook. This is how the virus is spreading. So people are doing things like opening attachments on their email that they shouldn't. They're using USB keys that they did not personally buy. They're going to websites that aren't trusted, doing risky things on the internet, risky behavior that probably many of them know that they shouldn't do, but they make a value calculation and decide that it's worth the risk. So we have a chance here to change that behavior. So how do we stop viruses? In all things, we need people, process, and technology. So we need a multi-pronged approach. In the public health field, instead of people, process, technology, they say something to the effect of behavior, medical, environmental. So we can kind of edit that a little bit to be behavioral, an engineering solution, and an environmental solution, or policy and industry solution. And before I go any further, just to explain the way that I did these slides. So when I first had the topic, I was really excited about what I could sort of do with the slides and make it really fun. And while a talk about sex, drugs, and computers could lead me to put some really fun pictures in, maybe some sexy pictures, there's recently been a movement in the community spearheaded by the geekfeminism.org site, and they have some guidelines where they ask people after a certain incident to no longer put things like babes in bikinis on the slides. So if you will just bear with me, the slides might suck, but every picture has a double entendre, if you will. So when you see my cheesy clip art, just think to yourself personally what the double entendre might be, but don't say it aloud, because I think it is important that, although, you know, personally I'm a very sex positive person, I think that, you know, modeling and art can be very sexy but still empowering for women. I do think that we need to focus on creating a safe space for everyone. So without really knowing the Nauticon crew very well, this is my first Nauticon, I wanted to make sure that this presentation stood the test, was fun for everyone. So you can play along with this sort of mini game in the background and think about why I posted each of these pictures, but don't say it out loud. Prevention of risky behavior. There has been impressive success in a study about the HIV AIDS virus, using group therapy to change risky behavior. And in public health, they call this an evidence-based intervention strategy, and it shows repeated success. And the study says, among injection drug users and other high-risk drug users, evidence-based intervention reduces overall sexual risk by about 86%. Interventions targeting high-risk heterosexuals find similar effect sizes for sexual risk reduction, condom use, and reducing STIs by about 74%. So these are incredible statistics. And if we could get that kind of adoption and success in a behavior change for internet behavior, then it would be an overwhelming success. And this is these are statistics for the first year. This is an example intervention program. This is the actual process used by an intervention program taken to increase prevention, increase sterile syringe usage in injection drug users in Harlem, New York, to increase prevention of AIDS, the AIDS spread in New York. And so they have, once again, they have a multi-pronged approach. Even if you break it down to the behavior aspect, you're always going to use a multi-pronged approach. And here they break it down to the individual level, the peer network level, the institutional level, and the community level. And I want you to focus specifically, if you don't read the whole slide necessarily, but focus on peer group network level, using harm risk reduction in group sessions for injection drug users. And today we're going to focus on group sessions for behavior change. So a peer group intervention. You need four things to create a successful peer group intervention. The first thing is peer education. When you focus on what curriculum you're going to discuss during your intervention, you need to make sure that it comes from a peer group. So everything needs to be tailored to your audience, and specifically not necessarily the scientific or the technological data, but the topics need to come from the peers themselves. So they need to be integral in planning as well as participating. The second thing you need is what they call in the study a diffusion of innovation. And this really means incorporate your rock stars. You'll get much more buy-in in your group intervention if you have people that are looked up to in the community as part of your intervention. And this is just, you know, human nature. People want to be involved in the cool thing. They want to be involved in something that's fun and that they can tell their friends about. You know, this is a fancy way of saying something really obvious. You also need social network intervention. And I don't mean Facebook necessarily in this case, but the idea that we bring in our social network and we represent more than just ourselves when we come into a group. So we have access to a network of people, and you can capitalize on that to bring that entire network into your group, whether it's actually, whether people actually bring their friends into the physical group location, or whether there's a dissemination of that information later on. And the last thing you need to create a successful peer group intervention is the focus on location. It's extremely important that the people in your group all come from the same either social or geographical location. There needs to be a common baseline. And I think when we do our group demo later, we will see that here in this room, we all come from the same location and we all have the same things in common being Nauticon and attendees. So look for that, look for how that plays out later. So what are the challenges? Just up front, I will tell you that there are a lot of challenges when doing a program like this. And the first challenge is the temptation that this is going to be a silver bullet, that you can have the focus on one thing and that that one thing will be a cure for your overall problems of behavior. And it's definitely not the case. In the AIDS intervention studies that we see, there is definitely a three-pronged approach. And while this is an important part, it is only one of many pieces. You also need strong leadership. You know, when we talked about the diffusion of innovation, you know, getting your leaders to be involved can be difficult. You know, if you don't have the right buy-in from top management for your program, your organization isn't going to support it, and then it's going to fall apart. So you need somebody that is a peer, because this is peer group intervention, but you also need somebody that can be a leader and walk that line between being on the same level but being a leader in that group. And that can be tricky. You also need radical behavior change. This is not something that we can measure unless there is a radical change. So having a couple people trying to change their behavior on the internet a couple of times isn't going to be measurable, and it's not going to be enough to say that we had a successful change. So that's really difficult. It's asking a lot. The next thing is we need widespread coordination. We need to have coordination across groups. If we don't, otherwise we won't have enough peers in one specific area. So we need to think larger than just the conventional, what conventionally is thought of as a team. And we need a single, simple message. So this is a fine line between not wanting monotherapy, you know, focusing on one thing too much, but also needing simple messages. So be very clear about what your goals are with your behavior intervention, and make sure that everyone is on the same page, that you think success is, you know, not using USB keys that aren't yours, not using public access points for company business, not using Facebook on the company network, and, you know, very specific things that can be measured and you can see a reduction in. It also needs to be tailored to the group. We talked before about having a peer as the leader, but also bringing the peers into the creation of the curriculum, the education materials. So that can be a challenge because it's more so the case that training and security awareness seminars are created by professional people that do this for a living. And it's usually not the case that you ask people that don't know the information what they should be teaching you. So it's kind of counterintuitive. So this can be difficult to get right. And the last thing is sustaining change is difficult. In the study that I showed you first, there was a 70 to 86% change in the first year, but unfortunately that number drops drastically after the first year. So people that don't stay in the program definitely regress. And that's a big difficulty. So it's important to have that buy-in so that you can keep the program going. This is an ongoing behavior change, and we want to focus on behavior every day. And so that needs constant attention. This is just a quick slide to show you that there are different types of group therapy. The kind of thing that I'm talking about is probably best in the behavioral, cognitive behavioral therapy group. So that's the idea that cognitive side, you know, you you have a choice. You are able to make the decision to change your risky behavior. And that decision that decision can come through a talking therapy style. And the behavioral part, you know, this is an activity, and it's going to be focusing on your behavior. This is a completely different style of a trial that shows that there is substantial success in group therapy style training for changing risky behavior. Here we have an eating disorder study where cognitive behavioral therapy by itself as an individual had a 48% success rate, but cognitive behavioral therapy as a group had a 68% success rate. So there is a clear difference that we as people want to learn as groups, and we work better as groups, and we are more willing to make behavior changes when we see other people doing it, and we're more encouraged to make behavior changes when we're the only ones not doing it. You know, when you can really see what's going on in your group, you as an instinct try to form yourself to the group. And I think a second part of the same study, they measured obesity, and of course there was less weight loss with the cognitive behavioral individual therapy and more weight loss with the cognitive behavioral group therapy. So those are things, the weight they could actually measure, and they were able to prove success. So a summary of what we've learned so far. We've learned that what works is group therapy moderated by an indoctrinated peer. We've learned that what doesn't work is, actually I don't think I have discussed what doesn't work necessarily, just the challenges. So let me say here that what doesn't work is scare tactics, authority, and a lack of infrastructure. So it's funny that you would think with AIDS being such a scary, you know, life-threatening disease, that scare tactics would be a large portion of how they do behavior change therapy, but it's actually not the case. It doesn't work. People understand the risks and they do them anyway. So using scare tactics, or in the security industry, what we would call FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, it doesn't work. And people don't respond to it. They justify it and they make value calculations that allow them to do this risky behavior anyway. So that's been measured and shown to not work. And we also talked about how you don't want an authority figure in the room when you're doing your group sessions. And if you can avoid it, you want as little authority involved in planning the curriculum as possible. You want to really get as much out of your peer group as possible in every step of the process, because authority is seen as something that is, especially in behavior, it is seen as negative, it is seen as something that is, you know, telling you what to do. And as human nature, I think we don't respond to that very well. And the lack of infrastructure, like I said, this has to be an ongoing process, and it can very easily fall apart without the right infrastructure to support it. And our goal is to change behavior in our everyday routine. So why this works? I have four reasons why I think this will work. And if at this point you don't exactly understand what it is that I'm saying will work, please raise your hand and let me know. I haven't done this speech in front of a group before, so it makes complete sense to me, and I'm really excited about this idea. But if you're not with me at this point, please let me know. So I have four reasons that I think that group sessions for risky behavior intervention for internet and security is going to work. One, it's an analogous behavior. The analogy between the way that we treat viruses for AIDS and the analogy between viruses for computers. I think the more that you look at it, the more you take it apart, we're going to see that they are like the exact same thing. And they're the exact same thing because it's really about risky behavior and the value calculations that we make when faced with a risky situation. The second thing is transactive memory systems, and I'll explain what that is. The third thing is shared leadership. We talked a little bit about that already. And the fourth thing is incentives. So the first thing is analogous behavior. Is this a good analogy for stopping computer viruses? And I would like to ask you guys if you're with me on this, if you can see the analogy. You know, you have viruses, safety, trust, spread, protection, prevention. All of these things are kind of the same language, certainly the same language, also the same concepts. Great. So, you know, to me, the more I pull this apart, the more I see that we can take a field that's got all of this data and research on how to deal with behavior and pull it into our field, and we don't have to necessarily do the same things. We can do, we can build on what's already been done. So I ask the question, can we learn from behavior changes in any form? Is behavior behavior? Is risk risk? Do we fear? Are we making a value judgment on our behavior on the internet based on a sense of personal safety, and the same way that we make a value judgment about safety when we are engaging in drug usage or, you know, sexual behavior? So I posit that we do, that behavior is behavior and safety is safety, and that we can edit our behavior in different industries using the same techniques. And I ask if, for those of you that aren't quite with me yet, I ask if it would help you to think of it in this terms. If internet is an addiction, if the reason that we've incorporated internet into every facet of our life is because there's an addiction, because we can't live without it, because we need it, you know, we make this, we do this calculation, the risk calculation, that we are willing to put all of our information out there for anyone to see, to get more points on our farm. You know, that sort of logic, when you say it out loud, doesn't make any sense. So it brings up the question, is internet an addiction? And when you start talking about addictions, there's an entirely different value set that you need to evaluate when you start talking about behavior. So if I didn't have you before, I hope that we're all in agreement now that that we can change risky behavior on the internet using some of these same strategies. And just to go a little bit further into it, you know, I've thought about this a lot, and there's just so many comparisons. You've got high-risk behavior, similar cost-benefit analysis. You've got the FUD aspect. You have this idea that it's a losing battle, that there are hundreds of thousands of people getting this disease, you know, HIV/AIDS, and there are millions of people that are getting infected by worms and computer viruses and malware on the internet. So it's it can be hard to fight a losing battle, and so there are a lot of the same emotional aspects to it. There's the aspect of political unrest, there's organized crime, there's shame, we need awareness, there's protection. You know, the condom metaphor is interesting when you start using it to apply to a network. The idea of treating infections as prevention, so stopping the virus by treating the virus, and rapid routine testing is an idea that I think is really interesting that we can pull out of this as well. But I don't know, maybe it's not all analogous. Maybe I'm just you know, drinking my own Kool-Aid, and I think that this idea is really great, but really it just doesn't make any sense. So there's all these other parts of the HIV/AIDS research, which is like circumcision leads to less spread of disease, and there's mother-to-child transmission issues, and like the antiretrovirals, in my opinion, doesn't necessarily translate directly to a technology issue. So so there's that. But you know, the more I think about even those things, I can see how we can learn from the activity, from the exercise of trying to figure out how these ideas would translate to technology. Because there is so much success in those studies, I think that we would be doing ourselves a disservice if we didn't at least try to see how they had success and if there's anything we can learn from it. So pulling those things apart, does anything else come to mind besides the things that is it too early in the morning for this? Does anything else jump out at you as far as like analogies between virology and security? It's 11 a.m. You have to wear a mask? Right, so an outbreak is the heightened awareness where you're overloading the system, and we need to focus on how we deal with those emergency situations.
I was going to say, as far as analysis is concerned, something's going to going back to previous slides, I think sometimes fear does work. There are people who work on it because they're like, well, okay, this person got the flap or this person got AIDS. And those people who run antivirus, or better yet, just don't run every single thing that they download off the internet because they've had previous experiences with bad scenarios.
That's a bad analogy because antivirus software doesn't do shit.
That is why did I preface it again with
So sometimes fear does work. We are, there has been use of condoms because we are afraid of catching something. Those numbers are lower than they should be, lower than you might think. But it's true that it has to be a multi-pronged approach. And so what works for some people, we need to catch everyone, even the people that it's not working for. Was there another one back there?
Cool, I get a microphone.
Great, thank you.
I'm special. Another problem you have is a lot of people, they not only pass the point of just not caring. Some of them, I actually saw a demonstration regarding AIDS, or a video on YouTube called Bug Catchers, where there's people who actually intentionally attempt to get the virus. So there's a point of where users just, they do not give a flip. They don't care
like
if they get
pot.
It or not. Yeah, I mean, well, exactly. I mean, so my point being is you can't change a user if a user is unwilling to change, or if they just care so little that it just means nothing to them.
It's true, and it's important to have, like, I kind of use the crutch of having an office organization environment to push this through. Like, there is a little bit of you're required to be here. Like, you're required to have good practices if you're going to be a member of a business organization. So we don't have the same requirements in our personal health that we do in our business professionalism. So that is a problem. And then a part where the analogy kind of breaks down.
I think one of the areas that differentiates the HIV epidemic from viruses on the computers is with an HIV epidemic, there's a sense of personal risk. If I get HIV, I could die. But in the case of computer viruses, and this goes both for corporate leadership and for the individuals who are exhibiting risky behavior, even though they know that these behaviors are risky, in most cases, there's not a sense of personal risk. You know, if I insert a USB drive into my work computer that came from some random guy in the parking lot, who cares? It's not going to affect me. It's just some dude's computer on the network and IT will come over and fix it. And it's the same thing with corporate leadership, where you emphasize how important it is to get buy-in from executives to push this kind of initiative. That's very hard to do when you have someone who is making that personal value judgment to say, well, I can either not get my $1 million and take my kids to Kenya for vacation this summer, or I can spend that money on thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars of awareness to my users. And they're not going to make that decision. They're going to take the money and they're going to run because they've got a $250,000 liability policy that they pay $10,000 a year for if they get breached.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
That is kind of where some of the fear mongering, fear can help us, but
I have the same kind of conversations when I'm trying to get people to care. And in my organization, you know, it's not your computer, but if you get your computer compromised, now you get an incident response gets involved, and hopefully you've done nothing wrong on your computer ever, and you can account for it. There's like, that's where I bring in the fear, and that does get their attention because they might not care about the work or the computer, but now there's an investigation against everything, and they might have problems against them. So that's where I do agree that in some cases it's not the same kind of fear, but I think it does work on the analogy that there is fear that can get you at least paying attention, and then that gets you to the next step.
I think there's the fear of the virus itself, and that's different than the fear of being fired or the fear of getting penalized. But we're going to have more time for questions in the next section, just to keep moving. Yeah. So the three other reasons why I think. I just wanted to clarify what I was going to answer. which is there are already budgets for security awareness in organizations. And so that's where I'm coming from, making those budgets more effective. And the things that we're doing now aren't working, and we can change the things that we're doing now. And I think we're using fear now to make people make decisions that, I have evidence to show that doesn't work. But just more than that, I think that a positive approach is just more healthy for the entire organization, and is less likely to bite you in the end. Anyway, so the second reason I think that the group sessions that mimic behavioral therapy intervention is transactive memory. According to Daniel Wagner, a transactive memory system consists of the knowledge stored in each individual's memory combined with the meta memory containing the information regarding the different teammates' domain of expertise. And there are some hyperlinks in there because I stole that directly from Wikipedia. So it's basically saying that the group is smarter than the individual, and the more you increase group knowledge, the smarter the group gets. So when we use group therapy, we are building a team that is using a sort of group style of training. And then you can measure the team's knowledge. And this is playing off of a talk that happened yesterday. Ghost Nomad was talking about how do we measure training success and how do we measure knowledge. So here I'm suggesting that it's just as important to measure the team's knowledge. And when you do that, if you measure the success of your training programs based on how much the team knows, you're going to get more success. And I think it's incredibly important for an organization to have success. And especially in security, we need wins. So being able to have this metric of team success is really going to increase the buy-in for the program, and it's just going to build on itself. And so eventually, if you keep up with the program, you're going to have members accessing the team knowledge for their personal individual use. And that does eventually happen. That's how we, as a community, learn from each other. It's sort of building on the idea of the hallway track at conventions. People talking to each other eventually start bringing those ideas to other places. They start internalizing them, and eventually they start using them. It doesn't happen right away, but you can really build team knowledge and have it translate to individual knowledge, according to this theory. So the third thing is shared leadership. We've talked about this in the beginning, where shared leadership means shared ownership, and you have a certain buy-in and involvement in the program that you don't necessarily get from a training program where everyone just shows up in a room and a teacher starts talking at you for 30 minutes. This is where we get our indoctrinated peer, and the point of the indoctrinated peer is it's somebody that is non-threatening to the group, that's trustworthy to the group, but also the indoctrinated part means that they have been exposed to the knowledge and the information that you need to communicate in your training program. And so they're going to bring those ideas out in a non-threatening way to the group without actually having an authority figure in the room. So it's a custom and a dynamic training. So it also thinks outside the box and changes paradigms. And the dynamic element of it is being able to take your peer influence and change the way that the training is going on the fly. So the last thing is that directive leadership is bad. And it's the same problem that people have with authority figures, that when you have directive leadership, you start to cancel out ideas that are not the ideas of the director. And it leads to groupthink, and groupthink is bad. It leads to ideas being silenced. And just in general, it's not conducive to how people think. The fourth reason that I think this program is going to work is incentives. The problem with talking about security awareness programs as if they were sex and drug rehabilitation therapy is that it's not. Security is not sexy, and it's not fun. It's not drugs, and it's not sex. So we need to compensate for that. I fully acknowledge that we need to pull in an emotional connection that just isn't there. and we compensate by having incentives. We try to bring an emotional reaction by making it seem worthwhile by using incentives such as like just bribing people. You know, make them excited about getting candy and t-shirts and Dave and Buster's. In Silicon Valley, where I live, I read the trade magazines, and people have conversations, like serious conversations, about the t-shirt effect. You know, you spend $8 a person for everyone in your organization, you give them a t-shirt that only the people in the organization can get, and all of a sudden they are part of a community, and they work together, and they're happier, and they think of like the group as something that they belong to, and it's their identity, and they will wear the shirt in other places. So this is a proven theory, the t-shirt effect. And Dave and Buster's, I worked in an organization for a while that loved Dave and Buster's. I did not love Dave and Buster's, but a lot of people do. And it seems like if you had your training program in the party room at Dave and Buster's, it would just be so exciting for people. And you would get a lot of buy-in that way. And so this is carrots, not sticks. We've proven before that that FUD doesn't work and that authority figures don't work, so sticks don't work. We want to focus on carrots. So what have we learned in this section? We've learned what we need to do to create a successful risky behavior prevention program. We first need a peer group. We need accurate knowledge resources. So that's going to be your training materials. So you do need training materials. And it's just about working those training materials in a way that's non-threatening to the group. You need a peer facilitator role. This is our indoctrinated peer that we talked about earlier. And the fourth thing is you need this the je ne sais quoi that is really interesting, that has the emotional connection that the sex has and drug use has for the people that are suffering from these diseases. They have just a strong emotional connection and a reason to be involved in the group. So we, once again, we need to compensate for that. If we're going to use the same behavior models, then we need to take that into account. So here I suggest that for security people using security awareness training, we should substitute sex for secrets. That the more we incorporate into a group, you'll see what I mean when we do our little demo here. That there are things that we can bring in that will create an emotional connection to people and really build a team out of this training seminar. So let's try it out. So I need 4 volunteers, and you can see if you want to cheat what I'm going to ask you ahead of time. 4 volunteers. Who got their certification last night?
I think they're all asleep.
Oh man, that's true. Okay, if you volunteer, just come up to the front of the room. Do you want to do it? Stand in front of the lectern.
Stand on that side so you're in the camera.
Can we get shirts?
Bribery.
She promised bribery.
Hey, that works.
Record the podium side so we can get on camera. Record your embarrassment.
Are you my indoctrinated peer?
I'm your risk factor.
Is this okay? Okay, I should have done this a little bit ahead of time. So if you read on the screen, which you can no longer see, it says that I'm going to ask you 3 questions. The first question is, what's your name? What do you do? Who are you? The second question is, what's something that you do on the internet at work that you know you're not supposed to be doing? It's like confession time. And the third question I am handing to you now. And these questions I'm handing out based on what I know about these people. So I'm using my meta memory about who these people are because I don't know you, but I basically know who these people are. But we're about to find out as a group who they are, and this is all part of the process.
Was I not supposed to volunteer?
No, you were. Cat feed is my plant. Arranged ahead of time. I'm doing a little school supply thing here. Hold on.
Scissors.
Oh, did I give you one already?
Yes, sir. On the back, you have your lucky number.
Really not sure about this.
Which one do you want?
You didn't put the smiley face on either side of the fortune.
Okay, so we're just going to start. If you don't know the answer, you can call a friend, okay? If you really don't know the answer, but I think you will. So Christian, if you want to start.
What was the question again?
First question, what's your name? What do you do?
Hi, my name's Christian, and I'm an alcoholic. No.
Second question, what's...
Touche. Yeah, I do sysadmin type stuff for a really big internet provider.
Third question, what's something that you do on the internet at work that you know you're not supposed to be doing?
That's a tough one, actually. Yeah, I know. I mean, I hate to say this, but I'm effing lame. I kind of know better, and if I'm doing anything that... should not be done at work, they don't stop me from bringing in my own laptop where I can do it on that rather than the work-provided machine. So I guess that's a gray area.
Do you take that laptop to other places and put it on other networks?
Yes. I know that, but, you know, I like to think that I know what I'm doing, so I can't be,
okay.
Infected or whatever.
There's an analogy if you want one.
That's right. Okay. Read your question. Try to answer it.
My question was, why is SSH a preferred file transfer protocol? Well, of course, you know, that's more like SCP or SFTP would be the file transfer part of it, but the fact that it allows encrypted communication between two points means you're unlikely to have your traffic sniffed, passwords passed, that kind of stuff. So, yes, it is a good, safe practice.
You, sir.
Okay. What's my first question?
What's your name?
I'm Joe Peacock.
What is your quest?
What is my quest? To find the Holy Grail.
What do you do for a living?
African or European? I'm the user experience and crayon monkey for FARC.com. And?
What's something that you do at work on the internet that you know you're not supposed to be doing?
Browse Reddit.com.
And what's the security implication of that?
Oh, honestly, that I won't get my work done because it's a time sink and it will destroy your brain. Yeah, day by day, month after month. Now, the security implication of browsing, right? I don't know. We all work from our own home offices, so I don't know that we are vectors for travesty. Once we're on the VPN, we're pretty much locked down. So thanks to that guy, Mike Andrews of FARC.com. With a blue hat.
Why don't you stand up?
Stand up.
Okay, then the last question is in front of you.
What is a rogue access point? I'll try to leave the Marvel Comics jokes out. I would assume that it's a vector for penetration, using the sexual analogies as much as I can. That's sort of left open, maybe unintentionally, on a corporate network or a secured network that I would be able to access, whether it be an open Wi-Fi port or, you know, a guest accessible login, maybe. Am I close to right? Can I call a friend? Mike?
Pretty close, yeah.
Andrews of FARC.com?
Is there something that you would add to that, Mike?
It's close. Is it give me the rest.
No, it's right.
Oh, I'm right.
Including bringing in your own personal Wi-Fi into the office, setting up your own little router.
Oh, so like if I brought my cell phone in and used it as an access point?
Yeah. Right.
So essentially, like,
on the backbone of the network. Right.
If my machine becomes the bridge between two networks where bad people over here can get into the good people stuff, I know what I'm doing.
So you can kind of see now how this is going to go. We're going to start with a question, and we're going to reach a conclusion as the group, and we're learning through doing.
Yay!
Okay. What is your name?
Tim, I go by Hacker Nick Teddy B. Yeah. So you see me carrying a bear around, that's what that's all about.
Okay.
What do you do?
I'd like to say I'm a student, mostly because of the fact that that's cooler than my day job. I actually just worked as an armed security officer as far as actual work, so I'm studying in system admin and penetration, that kind of stuff.
They give you a gun?
Yes, a 45 ACP. I had to buy it, though. It's mine.
Is there anything that you do on the internet that you know you're not supposed to be doing?
Well, technically, the apartment complex I work at has an open Wi-Fi connection, but given the fact that I work overnight, they may not care about the... I do IRC, I do torrenting, I work on war driving public networks in the area. So yeah, they would probably not really like all the studying I do if they knew all the details.
Excellent.
There are large amounts of wireless networks, and I look to see what's around, but I haven't, I played with FireSheep the other day, but I haven't actually sniffed people's traffic. I'm just kind of experimenting with tools.
And what is the question in front of you?
It asks an example of a tell that would lead me to suspect someone is social engineering me, which I actually, studying in penetration, would probably should have a better answer for that. But my general thought is, if I'm talking to somebody and if they don't have hardcore facts, usually I ask for details, you know? I mean, you detail, because if someone's social engineering, unless they're like Dave Relic Kennedy, who is really awesome at that, they're going to be and looking down and that kind of stuff, and that will kind of give you if they're trying to think off their feet.
Excellent. Okay, I forgot the bribe part. I should have done this first.
I was going
to
remind you
mind
of the bribe part.
Positive association. So pretend I did this first. Think of how happy you are because I'm giving you candy.
Yay! Oh, wait,
Do you want the peanut butter?
Starburst.
Do you want to answer your question? What is your name?
My name is Mark W. Schumann. I go by the hacker name Cat Food.
No.
It's a long story. What's my second question?
What do you do?
Oh, what? I get paid to make software projects not suck. I have a lot of input. Next question.
What do you do on the internet that you're not supposed to do?
At work? Okay, because I do lots of things on the internet I'm not supposed to, but just not at work. I don't know her that well. I think the number one security thing that I might do sometimes is outbound SMTP unencrypted, and that just doesn't seem right. it was just too hard to set up the encrypted server, and I don't know why.
So if that were easier, you would do it, but it's...
Yeah, it's an old version of BSD, yada, yada, yada. Well, that's the other thing. Yeah, logging onto a version 6 BSD server, that's just questionable.
And what is your question?
My question is, what are some security dangers of using Facebook? Well, one is, I would say there's a possibility of denial of service attacks, except Facebook itself is a denial of service attack. The number of times you get a script has stalled and gotten out of control, do you wish to stop the script or continue? And it's locked up the system so bad that even stop script won't stop the script. And that's a big one. Another one is my life is complicated, and I have this really intrusive ex, and you know, it's always awkward friending your own children on Facebook, because they've also friended mom. So now anything that's visible to friends of friends becomes a vector for invective. And sometimes you want to limit who knows too much about where you are, what's you know, you follow up on somebody, you comment on somebody else's wall post, and pretty soon you're getting some back channel about how that was perhaps the wrong thing to say, and it makes me feel very much less secure. And one that Joe mentioned is the problem with Facebook, like a lot of things, is the security issue being that it just can become a gigantic time sink. And so you end up not getting your work done, and then you get canned from the project.
That's
a
security issue, that is, though.
Yeah, and well, the thing
it's
is,
definitely a business issue, which is just as important.
Yeah, because you get canned, and then you lose your house, and you live on the street, and then it's really insecure because you have to live
then
at the shelter.
And you turn to a life of crime, and then you become a security risk.
Exactly, yeah.
All circle.
Yeah.
So we are almost out of time, but I wanted to talk about there's sort of a game element. To prove how transactive memory systems work, we have now created a meta memory about what these people know. So if we have a volunteer from the audience, I'm going to ask you to ask one of them a question. And you choose which one of them you think will know the answer. And if they do know the answer, then you get a Musketeers bar.
Do we get another one?
I haven't got my first yet.
Do we have a volunteer? You just have to ask the question, not answer it.
I was just going to interject real quick that I was fire sheeping myself, so that was my netbook. I wasn't like sniffing other people's traffic.
Dude, we're all the same.
I'm totally cool. White hat.
But this is
recording.
I don't browse Reddit.
So, which one of those four people do you think knows the answer?
I'll go with him.
Okay.
The smart one.
Christian?
Yeah, Christian.
Okay, Christian. What is a birthday attack?
Not a birthday suit attack.
Oh, damn. If I recall correctly, has something to do with the whole, like, I don't even know what to call it. I almost want to call it a paradox. The idea that of all the people in this room here, if I wanted to guess your birthdays, I forget what it works out to, but at least, you know, two or more of you will have a birthday on the same day or something like that. So the attack for that, I don't think that's an actual, you know, like I'm... Yeah, okay. I'm looking at you, man, because you picked me. But the idea that...
There's one element that you have to mention to get it right.
Birthday. Sex.
Disease.
Boop.
You know, I don't know. You just caught me a little unawares this morning. So, but I was going to say that's more helpful if it's some kind of... if I were social engineering someone... I would find that to be a little more handy.
Sure.
Just that kind of knowledge, you know, knowing that, oh, I might be able to spoof you better if, you know, I come sounding like I really know, like, when your birthday is or something.
Should I call for the audience to help you?
It's the reverend.
Okay. So we're basically done, but you get the idea that you can make things like this fun and have the group work on it, but we're learning as a group, and so the people that know certain things add to the knowledge of the people that don't, and everyone has something to offer. And I will give the last butterfinger to anybody that knows the last piece of what a birthday attack is.
It's used to explain why language
that eventually
you will have to
learn. There you go. Nicely done. Okay, so thank you all for participating in my little experiment.
Yes. Woo!